I will speak about diffusion theory-based models of demographic history, and same as Leonid, the topic doesn't involve a lot of microbial nor viral evolution in it. Though originally I became interested in studying more demography just by studying patterns of genetic variation in transposable elements in humans and learning from that patterns of genetic variation, I came to become very interested in demography in order to be able to learn some biology from those patterns. But the problem of demography is much more general. It pervades all type of analysis that we do from the new emerging DNA sequence data sets that we are obtaining these days, that in order to study, to read from that data any information on the demographic histories, on the underlying populations, or the role of natural selection that has had in shaping the genetic the patterns that we observe, we need like a very efficient mathematical tools that are able to like resolve all the underlying complexities up to more or less certain degree, and also mathematical models that allow to analyze like large data sets and do a statistical analysis of them such that we can obtain this information from models. Just to see how the demography and natural selection are so intertwined between themselves, we cannot really split one from the other. When we are studying variation within populations of the same species, usually one of the most preferred approaches is looking at the distribution of allele frequencies. And that evolution of allele frequencies, usually the two major forces that shape such a distribution are demographic forces and also natural selection. And as two examples of how these two patterns of genetic variation can be misunderstood, one is like a recent population growth can create a pattern, an excess of low frequency variants, which could be misunderstood as a signature of purifying selection. Another common mistake would be reading as hitchhiking effects or as epistasis effects some patterns of linkages equilibrium that are more rather caused by a signature of a recent admixture. Then in practice, most demographic histories that underlie the patterns of genetic variation in humans underlie many of these events, such that several population splitting events, if we start from a common ancestral population, gene flow between different populations at different gene flow rates, population bottlenecks, and so on and so forth. But one of the big limitations with the existing methods is that they work very well for relatively small numbers of loci and also very relatively number small of sample chromosomes. And that's why the growing amount of data demands for new methods in order to handle such type of data sets. And as a particular example that I'm really interested a particular biological problem that I'm very interested to apply these methods in order to learn about the biology is the biology of transposable elements. Then when two species such as the common ancestor of chimp and human, they split in the two branches, we believe that the first parts of the genome in diverging will be like transposable elements and also their host mechanism of repression. And here you see like a list of the different transposable elements that have accumulated independently on each branch. Then if you sum some amount of megabases, you can appreciate that it is pretty considerable. Already just in the human genome, 45% of the whole genome is made out of transposable elements, and just 20% of it is made out of lines, which is a particular type of transposable element that looks like, for some purposes, you can find analogies to it with a virus. If you look at, for instance, among these 1,000, almost 2,000 insertions that have accumulated since we split it with chimp, you can date, you know, every sequence is around a 6 kilobase long. Then you can, by looking at pairwise divergence, you can try to date and reconstruct the accumulation history of those line ones as function of time. And what you observe is a recurrent distribution of peaks of times in, you know, if you use a molecular clock and if you sum these two subfamilies of line ones, you will find a big peak here. And in order to understand this big peak and what caused it, one has to understand what demographic forces and also what changes in transposition rate and how both became intertwined to manifest and to give rise to these patterns that we observe. Then, even if I have mentioned as a one application, like looking at polymorphism of transposable elements, and this is a very particular type of a dielectric marker where we are interested if in what frequency a particular insertion is absent or present in the population. For the rest of the talk, I will talk about dielectric SNPs. Then we are interested about sequence orthologous bases, and we observe like two different versions, two different alleles of that particular nucleotide segregating the population. Then the model is very, very standard. It goes back to Fisher and Wright. And in order to understand the evolutionary dynamics, one just considers binomial sampling. The size of the sampling can change as a function of time. And this is given by changes in effective population size. And also, a certain rate, we can include like new mutations that enter the population. All this was formalized by Kimura under the name of the infinite size model. And one can make it more complicated, and for instance, adding a population splitting event, then one has an ancestral population with these new mutations that appear. We consider like two identical subsets of the population with different population sizes at the splitting time. And since then, the two populations keep going, evolving, and the random sampling on each one. And the gene pool of the set of chromosomes in each population at each generation comes mostly from the population itself, and also certain small percentage comes from its sample at random from the neighboring populations. Then this graphically summarizes the model that we have to study in a forward diffusion fashion, how a multiple Wright-Fisher process plus mutation can take place. Then graphically we will denote such a multiple population process as this type of trees, where most of the information in the model can be summarized as the time where the populations split. This is the effective population size of the ancestral population. We have ancestral population sizes after the splitting. Some gene flow that might be symmetric doesn't have to be. And also consequent effective population sizes, splitting events with different migration rates, and also different population sizes that can change as function of time. Then this is the type of model that anyone can program in a simulated fashion. But if we want to compare the patterns that we observe at this time and to learn from the history by looking at the data, we rather have very powerful and efficient tools to be able to move freely around the parameter space in order to read the possible and more plausible demographic scenarios that took place. Then a very important assumption is that we will assume that all the loci recombine freely. Then there is no recombination on loci, and that a simple way to assume this is that instead of sampling very linked loci, one can sample just like assume like a distance and up in a very large distance between loci, and sampling just those loci that are very far apart such that that assumption is consistent. And then the most important quantity that, or the quantity that we observe at the present time that our model is going to reproduce, and that's how we're going to compare our model with the data, is the so-called allele frequency spectra. And this is the aim of our model, to try to reproduce this object. And the allele frequency spectra, the multidimensional allele frequency spectra, is defined in a very simple way. Then one looks at the several SNPs genome-wide, all of them, for simplicity, are taken to be dialectic, and we look at the frequencies in k different populations. And we have k populations that they come from some ancestral population event, some ancestral population, the demographic history of those populations probably involves several population splitting events, and what we observe is like at each single loci there is a particular distribution of frequencies for each SNP. Then we take we sample each point. What we observe is something like this. For instance, this is like 2,000 SNPs sampled from Europeans, and I think this is European, some Europeans and Northern Europeans, and this would be the type of data that we are handling. In practice, we never know which is the real allele frequency. What we know is just finite samples, then we are not sequencing all the population. What we sample is for each population, we have a certain number of haploid genomes that we can sequence, and what we really know is a finite observation. And the connection between the distribution of allele frequencies phi x that I denote as phi x and is a density, probability density defined on the k cube, and our finite observation is just given by counting at random, by projecting this density on our discrete state space, which is basically the number of observations that we do, the number of SNPs that we observe with this particular combination of direct alleles. Then in this case, this would be in the first population, how many SNPs we observe in I1 chromosomes, where this would be smaller or equal than N1, the sample size, and in the second population, I2 and up to IK. Then we measure, and that's the information, the data that we really have. And these are two particular examples. If we have just one population, this is the standard figure of a finite observation of the allele frequency spectra, where we have the total sample size, and we have rooted all the SNPs. We know what the ancestral state, what's the mutation, what's the mutant, and we simply count how many observations we have in our data set. We can do the same also for if we consider two populations, then we root all the SNPs, and we count in how many chromosomes for one, how many chromosomes we observe the derived state of the associated SNPs, and so on. This quantity or finite observation of the allele frequency spectra can be generalized for an arbitrary number of populations, and that's what our model aims to calculate. For in the case of humans, this is just to get a picture of how real data, this is highly ascertain, and there is we would expect the peak of frequencies being at 0, 0, but the ascertainment protocols like do undersample like low frequency variants. And this is from the HapMap, a comparison between, this is a two-dimensional allele frequency spectra, 200 chromosomes sampled for each population. We have Europeans in the x-axis, Europeans in the y-axis, Europeans and Chinese. And very important quantities in population genetics, like the average FST, for instance, can be read as average, as a certain average observables or average quantities under this density. Then these two populations clearly are closer to the diagonal. The density is more peaked along the diagonal, which if we compute the average FST, we would obtain a smaller FST. We compute the average FST of this density, we obviously, the two populations are not so, are more spread, we obtain a slightly higher FST.
So how do you outgroup direct these?
What?
How do you direct these spectra? Like, how do you know the ancestral?
You can only know it probabilistically. Then you align human genome with chimp genome, and also you can also with macaque.
Okay.
And you, there are like sometimes you have like misidentification probabilities depending for the CPG in CPG context.
But in this case, did you use chimp or?
Yeah, I use chimp. I use chimp and a correction for a probability for misidentification. In the mostly it's significant for in the CPG context. then humans evolve much slower than viruses, then ancestral states are much easier. And the history about how Allele-frequency spectra infinite size model have came in population genetics is goes back, as I mentioned, to Fisher and Wright, which worked mostly with a one population case. Kimura also introduced the infinite size model and introduced partial differential equations to solve such a model. In the case of coalescent theory, Wakely and Hay were first in computing the join, the multidimensional join allele-frequency spectra for two populations. Hudson introduced Monte Carlo simulations, and recently there has been a literature to come back to the Kimura's partial differential approach, but in the higher dimensional case, and that's where the talk will be headed. And why to go back to partial differential equations? The simplest reason is mostly the computational burden. Then if one wants to use a Monte Carlo simulation, which is far easiest to program, it's very slow because you have to do a very computational intensive like explorations of the parameter space, and to solve the diffusion at one point of the parameter space can take like half a day, depending on the complexity of your model. But you have to simulate the history of each SNP, and that's very slow. In the coalescent, you have to sample trees within trees. You have the gene genealogies, and within the gene genealogies have to fit within the population tree, and you have double trees when you scale the number of populations increases. Try to infer the allele frequency spectra from coalescent simulations also becomes very, very computed, computationally demanding. Then the nice thing about using diffusion theory is that one can handle more than two populations with migration with relatively facility, and also one can incorporate like natural selection coefficient very easily. Then there are incorporating selection in coalescent modeling is very, very hard. It can be done, but almost nobody tries it in practice because it's a very technically challenging problem to solve. However, in the diffusion equations, we know since Kimura's time that is just adding one term in the first derivative term of the diffusion equation. And this is the partial differential equation that is the limit of the Markov chain process that I defined at the very beginning. What you have is one tree, as I specified before, and you have several diffusion processes. Then you start with a diffusion process in one dimension. After a population splitting event, you have a diffusion process in two dimensions. And after a third, fourth effective population splitting event, what you have is a process in k dimensions. Then the way to connect diffusion in one dimension to diffusion in another one is just assuming that the distribution of allele frequencies sit on the diagonal. It introduces a Dirac delta. That would be the natural way to connect the diffusional process, is the natural way to connect the different diffusional process at the population and splitting events. Another two technically demanding, the technically important problems that one has to solve are the boundary conditions and also the influx of mutations. Then mutations are assumed to enter just single on each population, and also then they enter, basically mutations are going to enter at the edges on the K-cube. They can only enter in one population. The other problem about the boundary conditions is that some alleles can, if the migration is very low, the migration rate is very low, some alleles can reach fixation in one population but still becoming polymorphic in a second third of the remaining populations. Then to combine and synthesize all these boundary conditions, one has to take into account all these effects at the time of solving this partial differential equation. There are two classical numerical approaches to solve them. One involves like using a grid, a finite grid, and a method like a Kranz-Nicholson method, and these are very robust methods that allow like complex analysis of complex demographic scenarios where two or three populations. And the other possibility is, instead of approximating functions using a grid, one can use a polynomial expansion. These are known as spectral methods, then ways of solving partial differential equations using polynomial approximations to the solutions of the PDEs are known as spectral methods. They are more difficult to implement, but the advantage is that they are preferred for when the domain where the PDE is, the dimension of the domain is high and the solutions are smooth. And why is that? It's a very simple known fact from classical mathematics. If we approximate any smooth function using a grid or using a polynomial expansion, here we have lambda points, lambda grid points, here we have lambda coefficients, polynomials up to the grid lambda. If we compute just the error on the interval between the true function and our approximation, a grid, the piecewise linear grid approximation decays as a power law, the polynomial expansion decays as following an exponential decay. Then if we want, you know, by using just 20 or 15 polynomials, we are going to attain a degree of precision and accuracy that otherwise with a grid we wouldn't be able to do it. An important thing is that as we include more and more populations, the number, the finite dimensional approximation that we are using for those spaces of densities scales as lambda to the power of p. Then a grid might be fine for 2 and 3, to use a grid, but as we go bigger than 3, if we want to also find approximations for 4 or 5, the SM needs to be much bigger, the number of grid points needs to be much bigger than the number of polynomials. The scaling properties like favor the use of polynomial expansions in the case of higher dimensions, or in this case in population genetics, a high number of populations. Then our ansatz is using these truncated polynomial expansions, where this is certain basis in some Hilbert space, and these coefficients depend as function of time. Then after projecting our partial differential equation into this so-called Fourier space, what we find is a simpler equation in ordinary differential equation in the Fourier modes. And this can be solved numerically using one of the many available methods to solve ordinary differential equations. The other problem, the problem of using polynomial expansions is that some of the objects that appear in this model are generalized functions, are distributions, are not truly smooth functions, like Dirac deltas. Then in order to approximate such an object by a polynomial expansion accurately, one needs to introduce a regularization. A very simple example of how a Dirac delta appears is in Kimura's classical solution of random drift and mutation in this infinite size model in one population. The way, if this is our initial density, this is basically the solution to the diffusion equation by using an initial condition picked at p. And this term will describe the influx of mutations at frequency 1 over 2n every generation. And this term is highly singular because we are injecting mutations in the population exactly at frequency 1 over 2n. And if you indeed use a truncated expansion to Kimura's solution, with this mutation rate, you are going to get Gibbs phenomena. This thing is not going to converge. And many of the people who try to use Kimura's solution in practice with mutation, they use another different method, such as finite differences. And the major difficulty, it comes from Gibbs phenomena associated with inclusion of a Dirac delta exactly at 1 over 2n. Then part of the work was to substitute this mutational model by a more general effective mutation density. And instead of assuming that mutations center the population exactly at frequency over 1 over 2n, we assume that the mutations can enter a more stochastic manner, very close to zero, and with certain weight, and very peaked near zero. Then one can work out which are the most general effective mutation density that is going to converge to the standard model, and what we obtain is this. I don't think this is very clear, it's difficult to see, but what we compare here in red, we have the equilibrium density associated to the standard solution, and in blue we have a regularized effective mutation density that can be approximated very accurately with polynomials up to degree 6, polynomials up to degree 12, and polynomials up to degree 18. And you could go to choose a degree of the polynomial as high as you want. The conclusion of this is that one can use a more general notion, such as this one of effective mutation density, and that this equilibrium dynamics of the partial differential equation is going to converge to the same solution that one had with a standard model for the standard mutational model, but there will be a distortion at very low frequencies. Then that's the price to pay. But this distortion can be chosen as small as you want, as you increase, as you are willing to introduce more and more polynomials in your expansion. The other problem, as I was mentioning, are the boundary conditions. When the boundary conditions also are highly singular, then the way that we solve the problem is to assume that the density, the polynomial expansion in the density, can be decomposed in several boundary components. Then in the case of two populations, one would have a two-dimensional density living in the bulk, and we will have four densities living just in the boundary. Then when mutations, for instance, would just alter the diffusion equation associated to this ancestral density of allele frequencies, and mutations entering population 2 would affect this second density. Migration events can bring back some of the SNPs that are fixed in this boundary, can bring them back to the bulk, and so on. Migration events could bring back SNPs which were fixed in this boundary to the bulk. The only true observing points would be the ancestral state in both populations and the derived state in two populations. When we move back to dimension, we are working with the K-cube, and we have only two points observing and two observing points, the ancestral and derived state, and we come with a more complicated dynamics, but this can be solved. Then what we have shown on this theoretical side of the talk is that we can use truncated polynomial expansions to solve the diffusion processes that approximate the infinite size model, and with it we can analyze demographic processes on population trees that involve influx of mutations, random drift, migration, multiple population splitting events, and so on. And despite that many of the objects that appear in the model originally were non-smooth, we have found like ways to handle those non-smooth functions such that mutation densities or population splitting events, such that they can be dealt with a smooth object that can be approximated with these polynomial expansions. Then the idea is, for given any tree topology and some set of parameters, this would allow us to compute the density of derived allele frequencies in the population in the final, at the present time, and also by performing binomial integrals, we can model the finite observation that we would expect to observe in the data. But now, I would like to talk a bit about the real data. This is a comparison between the two methods. I mean, there has been some work on the literature done working with finite differences using a Kramnik-Nicholson finite difference scheme, and also using a mutational model that is unknown, is a black box so far, and also imposing a very zero flux at the boundary. Then what we observe is that we compare one polynomial expansion to the finite differences method is that DADI, this decode that implements finite differences, is much faster. We use one single CPU, but it gives a very fast and accurate and decent approximation to the solution, but it doesn't converge. And we suspect that why it doesn't converge is because it uses a very simple, something in the mutational model or in the boundary conditions that are highly simplified, like gives some distortion. On the one side, it gives a high speed, and it's very good, and it gives a decent approximation, but look at the order of magnitudes are very different. Then already with just a 15 polynomial, this is a two population scenario, we would be around minus 1.02, and this is just for 15 polynomials. And this is the logarithm of number of points, grid points, per dimension. Then this is e to the 7, approximately, roughly speaking. And if you choose like a very fine grid choice, the method doesn't converge. And I don't think that's because the Crank-Nicolson, it's more something about the boundary conditions of the or the mutational model, or both. Then one of the data sets that we run in order to test and to see how the code is working was this. We work with data from T.L. Turner in Nature, that he published in Nature Genetics in 2010.
Excuse me, sorry, back to one last slide. So the analysis Carlos's lab was doing for multiple populations of joint allele frequency spectrum.
Yeah.
So you think that parameters people get with DALI may not be exactly.
Every time that you run DALI, you always get close. Somehow you always get close, but it doesn't converge exactly. Then I don't think all the parameters that people are getting are like some estimate, but they contain some inherent deviation. But genetic data is also dirty. Then I don't
try to run your method on 1,000 genome data or.
I'm running now, and I have a couple of slides at the end for EGP that DALI was originally run on, the Environmental Genome Project data. Then I have run it on it. But I will talk about that later.
You get different parameters, right?
Slightly different, and it's matter. These are parameter spaces have a very high dimension, and the data itself is very noisy. But the parameters might be different. It will be matter to quantify. Then so far this is like work in progress. I mean, running these data, it takes a lot of time because they're high dimensional spaces. You have to evaluate the likelihood points chosen at random in the parameter space. And there might be difference, but we'll see how significant they are. But this is what we observe. I mean, I generated the data using a Monte Carlo simulation, very clean, using the Dirac delta, the standard model of the diffusion, you know.
Well, if you run SFS, right, so if you run just direct forward simulation.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I did. I ran a forward diffusion simulation, like using 150,000 points, such that the error of the likelihood will be very, very small. Then I normalize the likelihood of the simulation to be -1, and I evaluate for different grid sizes. I evaluate DALI, and I also evaluate my code, and this seems to be converging. You cannot reject that it is converging to the exact solution because you are using a finite number of SNPs. It's just 150 right. Simulated data, but it is significant that it is not converging. But still, it is getting close. It's -1.03. It's a 3% of difference, but it's a 3% of difference. It's not, and you're choosing e to the power of 7. I think these were, in this case, I chose like 2,000 or 3,000 points per dimension, where DALI is very slow. It takes a lot of time. You use much more memory to run on such a fine grid.
And also, another question is, you can get analytical solution without migration. Right?
Yeah.
So again, you can technically simulate migration because this is finite difference solution. You can simulate migration by just mixing distribution once in a while, right, and following an.
I don't know how would you might break the correlation because you are simulating migration in the full two. If you have two populations, you have the two-dimensional allele frequency spectra. Then I think what you could have is like a mixture events.
No, I have an analytical solution within each population, but I change. I sort of add a little bit of alleles from one population to another, right? So I shift my distribution of frequencies every once in a while. So this seems like computationally very efficient strategy to me, but maybe I'm wrong here, I don't know.
I'm not sure. I mean, in the case of no migration, like the spectral method basically converges to the Kimura solution because now this mutational model is a smooth function. You can approximate it. It's very peaked. You can, with zero migration, you basically obtain like traditional Kimura solution. I'm using a different basis of polynomials, but it's the same space. And even in that, where the solution is very clear, that it is off like 2%, 3%, sometimes it's just 1%. But the point is that it always gets close. Then I don't think the estimates that people are getting are are huge deviations of the truth. then one of the data sets that I ran was four different populations of Arabidopsis lirata. They are now crossing diploid. They have a very small genome, and they are very similar to Arabidopsis thaliana. This allows us to have a very well annotated genome, and also a way to try to root the alleles and try to isolate those regions of the genome which are like non-coding intergenic, and they are a very low conservation. They are very lowly conserved, such that the neutral assumption that we do in these models is going to hold. Then the four places where these populations were taken are in the Northeast, in between Maryland and southern Pennsylvania. One of the peculiarities of these populations of lirata is that two of them are adapted to some type of soil, that is serpentine, and the blue ones in Pennsylvania are adapted to a more granitic type of soil. And they sample like 25 diploid individuals per population. They, after rooting with thaliana, we found more than 8 million SNPs. Of those, more than 5 million were annotated as non-coding, but only 3,000 SNPs were polymorphic in the four populations simultaneously. Then this implies that these four populations have diverged highly. And how the SNPs were computed, how the allele frequencies were computed, is that they didn't sequence, they pulled DNA from the 25 individuals. Then they did a 39-fold coverage, but every time that they were sequencing each sequence of DNA, it was a random sequence from these 25 individuals that you don't know which is which. Then the data that one has is not the number of chromosomes where the derived allele was found, is the number of counts where the derived allele was found. But by using a very simple Bayesian analysis, one can estimate given the total number of sample individuals and given the number of counts, we have a posterior probability distribution on the possible counts on the number of chromosomes where the allele derived state was found. Then the log likelihood can be defined in such a way. This would be like empirical data, and this would be the prediction of our model given a tree topology, some of the tree topologies that we have specified before, and also the set of parameters that involves migration rate.
Excuse me, do you optimize it with EM?
What?
So there was a method developed in Michigan and where people try to do pretty much the same thing, so to estimate true allele frequency based on a low coverage data, and if you maximizing it with EM. And the data I've seen, it doesn't converge to the true allele frequency distribution for reasons I don't understand. So I don't know if you looked at any sample where was either high coverage or Sanger sequencing, and you recovered the same spectrum.
That's a very interesting question, but right now I have been concentrating more in the human data, and that's where what I'm really, the data that I'm going to present later on, and the one that I will, I'm writing. About this particularly, this was mostly used to run the code and to see where it goes. How good the quality is and how this approximation might hold, I'm not aware, but thanks to mention, I think this is a very important, because in the future, this will be a very important source of data to try to sequence in a cheap way allele frequencies in populations. And taking into account all the possible errors will be very, very important to extract meaningful information. But so far, the major goal was to run the code, to see if we could see some significant signal from the data set. I think we did. We have 49, in this case, 49 free parameters. We used there was problems with folding, with trying to root the states using thaliana, because in, among other things, thaliana has smaller effective population size in longer term than lirata. It's not like chimp and humans, where chimps in the long term has this bigger effective population size, and root humans with chimp is easier. In this case, it wasn't so easy, but we worked with the folded allele frequency spectra. Then for each point in the parameter space, solving this four-dimensional problem took between 125 seconds and 200 seconds to solve the diffusion equation. Evaluating the allele frequency spectra is another story, because one has to compute the histogram. but this is just the speed of solving the diffusion equations. We explore the parameter space, combining like mixture of sampling and random mixture of Gaussians, and also using local methods like quasi-Newton and also downhill simplex methods. And what we found, among the most important signal, it was like we couldn't reject gene flow coming from fourth population 4 to population 2. I mean, all these effective population sizes and also these time scales are consistent with a model where there was highly divergent populations after the last glacial maximum. And the major explanation why there might be gene flow coming from population 4 to population 2 and not on the other side, not to the other ones, is because the longest river of the East Coast, which is the Susquehanna River, precisely acts as a boundary. I don't know if this is an important barrier for gene flow, but the data suggests that there is a barrier for gene flow there. And why the southern population has a significantly smaller effective population size might be related with the distribution of Arabidopsis ligata itself. Then it's a plant that is distributed around the North Pole, and the frequency of finding it as you go south decreases. This is how the plant is mostly distributed within the US. Then it makes it that the southern, most southern population, as it is closer to the domains where the plants are, should have a smaller effective population size. And now going back to your question, this is like the human data, which would involves trying to understand the human expansion out of Africa and also settlement of America. Then we have data from the Environmental Genome Project. We have 68 individuals from different ethnicities. One's Yorubans from Nigeria. Also we have white Americans from Utah, Chinese from Beijing, Mexicans. And the data was like Sanger sequence. It's like very high quality data, 5 megabases of DNA. We can isolate those SNPs. There are around 26,000 SNPs. We could isolate those SNPs, which are non-coding intergenic, they are low conservation, and we can assume that they have evolving neutrally. And also to evaluate more rapidly the allele frequency spectra, we constructed an adaptive allele frequency spectra. Instead of computing, if you have 20 individuals, you have 21 in this case to the power of 4 minus 2, which is the number of bins that the allele frequency spectra has. Instead of computing such allele frequency spectra, one can choose different bin sizes depending where the amounts of SNPs, where the SNPs are located. This can reduce significantly the number of integrals to compute, and also this reduces the computational burden. Then the model in this case has 17 parameters. It assumes an ancestral population at equilibrium that expanded like some number of generations ago, expanded quickly up to this ancestral population size of the Africans that has remained constant up to now. This is one of the assumptions of the model to reduce the number of parameters. There should be a first out of Africa event. Some ancestral population of Asians or Europeans came out. They split it a second time. Number of generations ago, and now one has like Europeans and Asians, and Asians already split it again in order to found to have the founders of the peoples of the Americas. And at the end, as we have data not from Native Americans, we have data from Mexicans, from LA, we assume that there has been some admixture between this ghost population, which is a Native American population, and also Europeans, with some ratio, some proportion that is specified.
Two questions here. So it looks like population growth should be dramatically important.
Yeah, population growth, there are three growth rates, I mean, not in the African, but there has been three growth rates for three populations.
So it looks like there are claims it's over exponential, but first, why African population doesn't grow? And second, why do you model the initial growth as explosion in the population size, because when you have one population, you can analytically come up with the distribution to start with, right? So.
The feeling sometimes is you could add as many parameters as you want, but sometimes you try to reduce. It's like the migration rates. Migration rates are clearly not symmetrical, but assuming migration rates are symmetrical reduces the number of parameters I use in the model, and you can get a very good fit. And a bit of the art is how small can we get our parameter size such that we predict the frequency spectra. We know how neutron markers are distributed, and we get a qualitative picture of what the demographic scenario is. At the end of the day, that's what a reasonable aim is. This is a very simplified model. Still, it's complex, but simplified. I agree that you could model better these population explosions. You could model better these population explosions. You could have like more migration rates. But for instance, if you had a migration rate between East Asians and peoples of the Americas after the founder event, you don't observe a significant, if you try to fit it, you don't observe a significant change.
The question is what parameters are critical, because if I look at only at Africans, for example, I can model it very well with population growth and no migration, but it's very difficult for me to model it with migration and no population growth. Right, so it looks like continuous growth is a key property. I understand that you have to constrain parameters. There's no way.
Yeah, the more you go anyway, the more you go back in time, the less certainty one should have. Then it makes sense to have a more detailed population growth model for the very recent phenomena, and try to be as simple as possible the more back in time you are. And that's the philosophy. The model gets very simple, the simplest the better as you move back in time, and you can afford being a bit more complex when you are analyzing, when you get very close to the recent state. Then that's the major reason of why to add this. If you're just an equilibrium density and you just assume that the density was equilibrium, you obtain a significantly worse fit. You say, well, what happens if there has been like sudden change in population size? You get a disequilibrium initial density in one population, and you reconstruct the whole allele frequency spectra based on that, and you get a much better fit. That's the major reason. But what happened in the past, including like Neanderthal gene flow, who knows? I mean, so the hominid history is very complex. Then there is no end. Then keeping the model as simple as possible really helps. And the numbers are pretty consistent. But again, these are just a preliminary data given confidence intervals, given a Fisher information matrix. This is very preliminary. We obtain a bit more recent splitting population times and slightly smaller migration rates than that ED. But this is the maximum. This is the maximum of the likelihood. Then what we are doing now is like giving a more complete exploration of the parameter space, because there one thing that I have there is some work done in the literature, but because the difficulties of the coalescent is very difficult to study, and with these technologies easier to study, is the correlation between splitting times and migration rates. There is a clearly sometimes it's very difficult to decide between a model that has a very recent splitting time and very low migration rate, or when you have a very long splitting time and very strong migration rate. And just trying to give a very accurate description of the joint probability density on the full parameter space, and more particularly in correlation of these significant parameters, migration rates, splitting times, or the growth rates and the initial population size at the bottleneck and so on, it will highlight the limitations and advantages of this modeling.
Yeah, the worry here, of course, if you drop a lot of parameters, like if you drop all migration rates, the likelihood, would it decrease significantly or not?
That's a very good question.
We believe in migration rates, just demographically, but it may be that the model without any migration wouldn't.
I think it would be significantly worse, but you will find out fit. How good it would be, I'm not sure, but it will be these migration parameters. I mean, are not significant. I think these parameters, you can do a likelihood ratio test. They add information. Then they are non-trivial statistically. They are significant, but if you remove them, you can get something simpler and still fit it. I'm sure you could do it. Then just as a summary and conclusion.
The times are consistent with other.
I mean, there are many different studies, but
population, population of Americas is like 17,000. Is this close to
what?
17,000 years ago.
I mean, there are like, you see, if you look at the population of Americas, the estimate that we got here was 2000, a bottleneck initial of 2000.
The population size, the time, I'm saying,
you know,
time.
Oh, 17,000 years ago. Yeah, that's consistent. Like on some, this is consistent with
the bottleneck size is like pretty big, so 20.
Yeah, that's particularly big. We have not estimated. We need to estimate better the confidence intervals. But I mean, you have this is consistent with the results that Daddy got too. But there is, for instance, Jody has a paper where he estimated the bottleneck to be just 80, and that's not even within the confidence intervals that Daddy has. Then what exactly this bottleneck is, and what's the coupling between this admixture event? Between that mixing between Europeans and peoples of the Americas, and having a distortion of the where you basically are adding, you are like putting together. I mean, the difference between these two splitting times that we get are very small in the maximum likelihood peak in the peak. Then maybe what you are getting is like you are getting already extra gene flow by putting everything together, and you are underestimating the mixture coefficient. And these might be artifacts, and I think that's why the peak shouldn't contain as much information as solving completely the posterior the likelihood surface.
So this mixture coefficient of 32% is reasonably
small. 32% are Europeans, would be the percentage of Europeans.
Right. Is this because for Los Angeles Mexicans it was 50% was the published figure, but
it should be within the intervals. That would be, I mean, there are estimates like 48%, and you could have a down between 35%. I mean, it is not clear. Yeah. Then I'm worried that particular peak, and that's why I think one might be, by choosing the demographic parameters, you might be moving in a region of the parameter space where you are obtaining a significantly different. And I think the best we can do is like having a more complete exploration of the parameter space before, yeah, doing this. Then basically the main idea of the talk was to show how we have introduced this particular regularization for infinite size model using partial differential equations, modeling flux of mutations, population splitting events, and using this particular set of boundary conditions. This allows us to handle this multiple population Reifischer process using numerical methods, and this allows us to work with easily with four populations and a large number of parameters. And I would like to thank my major collaborator and supporter, Jody Hay, and also second collaborator, Kevin Chan. Thanks very much.
So you said that you can very well sample parameter space, but what about model space? So this is all done within the Reifischer framework. So are you considering other kind of models? Maybe you have some non-random mating and perhaps some spatial structures.
Spatial structure. You are suggesting a more general, like a spatial temporal.
Yeah. So is this framework that you are proposing, would you use the same techniques to solve that numerically as well? Is this not very specific for that diffusion equation that you are solving?
I mean, the diffusion equation approach works with an arbitrary number of populations that you can consider. They are more or less isolated, and they share a more or less recent common demographic history, and where the infinite size model also holds the assumptions of the infinite size models, then that would be how general is. But I don't understand well.
Perhaps the second question which you would answer, which is a little bit more philosophical, how far you can go when you have 100,000 genomes or something like that. So do you expect that you can get much more accurate, or is there a diminishing returns when you start having more and more genomes, and you do you have an idea? Is this basic picture going to change or not? What you are now seeing when you have much more samples.
The picture, you mean the estimation of the model parameters?
Yes. Engine? So this is a model that you're proposing now. Is that going to change dramatically when you start having?
It might change even, but I'm not sure how much. But I think what qualitatively, like significant signatures as gene flow, existence of gene flow, directional gene flow, changes in population size, then qualitatively those signatures won't change. The estimation of the parameters, I think they might change, yes. I think, and that's what one observes in the literature already. You know, these bottlenecks, like was 80, there was gene flow, depending what, but I mean, these models are very simplifying, and one will have more populations, there is population structure within Europeans and so on. Then we can just like zoom and refine methods to analyze more particular demographic scenarios where we have like different types of data set, and we can study the demographic history of some isolated set of populations. But answering your question, I think some of the qualitative results won't change. I don't think they're pretty solid. That existence of where the gene flow is going up to when, like some of the confidence intervals of the some of the parameters, what populations have been growing. If there is one population growth is significantly higher than the other, but exactly the rates, I think we'll see. I mean, they are like two different things, like exact numbers, what meaning have the exact numbers, and also by comparing the numbers, you can still have meaningful knowledge of the demographic history, and that one, I think that's very robust.
I think I'm allowed for a philosophical comment. I think the disaster for the field is the Nick Patterson's result that there is no unique mapping of site frequency spectrum to population history. So you can have multiple population histories giving exact same allele frequency spectrum, but as soon as you live within reasonable parameter space, so as soon as you can parameterize your model reasonably well, then you have unique solution, maximum likelihood solution, and then we can come up with probably more complex models with more data.
So I was getting to that direction because this is looking backward in time, and then so there are presumably some limits then.
Yeah, there are.
Well, it was very unfortunate to me to read this paper with the result that you actually, there is no way you can uniquely reconstruct population history with infinite amount of data and very, very sort of free-flowing model, so very complex model.
One other ingredient that might help the problem is that it technically is very difficult is to add haplotype structure and, you know, studying not just single SNPs, also studying how couples of triples of SNPs, but the thing is that once you include that, you include many populations, the level of complexity grows very quickly. But that's a source of information that we are not using, like haplotype structure we are not using, like a very rich source of information. And hopefully, like combining different sources of information, you could, because what Nick Patterson proved was he taking into account the allele frequency spectra of haplotypes, or he was just looking at single one lost locus?
No, there was no LD.
So it was one locus, right?
Yeah, LD may help. If you add additional types of data, I don't know how to deal with diffusion if you add recombination and multi-locus models. But this would definitely help.
You will, yeah.
One worry for parameter estimates I have is that generally people who study demography, they try to abstract the biological forces, like how much bias gene conversion shifts these distributions right out of what would be expected, or how much of selection and non-coding regions shift those distributions. So this, but maybe for the main picture, this is not such a big of a worry, but for parameter estimates, this may be, right?
Any more question or discussion? Then that's it.